then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One word more for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night, many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's May the 19th, 2011. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest.
There beside the singing river, that dark mass of men were seen, far above their shining weapons, on their own beloved green. Death to every foe and traitor, forward strike the marching tune, and hurrah, my voice for freedom, 'tis the rising of the moon.
I begin this week with something that frankly makes me want to vomit, but don't worry, I won't do so on the air. On Wednesday, May the 11th, the federal informant Larry Fairfax was sentenced to 27 months in prison with credit for time served, i.e. for 11 months. And that means he has 16 more months to do. Now, realistically, what with time off for good behavior and jail overcrowding and all that mess, Fairfax could be out of jail by Christmas. In fact, that's where he may stay, the county jail. Usually, when someone is that much of a short timer, some states don't even bother to send them to a state prison, but let them run out the clock where they are. This means that while Edgar Steele is now facing 30 years in prison, Larry Fairfax may never do a single day in actual prison itself. Steele himself is due to be sentenced in August, which I find extremely odd. They're holding off for some reason, and it makes me wonder why. There are, of course, two possibilities. Now, this is one of those points that happens in almost every podcast I do, when I stop and I think very carefully to myself, do I really want to say anything at all here? Because this is one of those topics where anything I say can and probably will be misinterpreted, in some cases deliberately, and a very distorted version of what I say will start going the rounds of the pseudo-intellectual blogs. But since this idea is so obvious that I know darn well I'm not the only person who'll think of this, I'll go ahead and mention it. It's possible that Steele's sentencing is being held off for two reasons, neither of them very nice. Now, the first possibility is that Edgar's health is very delicate. You got to remember that when he was arrested, he'd just come out of major open-heart surgery and was loaded to the gills with medication all the time in which he was supposed to be hiring a hitman to kill his wife and mother-in-law for insurance money, which later turned out to be non-existent. And it would be perfectly understandable that his health may well have broken down even worse under the strain of being convicted for a crime he did not commit. It's entirely possible that the federal government may have decided to give itself some time prior to sentencing to make sure that the potential embarrassment that Steele represents to them disappears for good. Now, they're very good in the prison system at withholding sick prisoners' medication from them. And at Steele's age, and in his present condition, it would be very plausible if he mysteriously suffers another heart attack in his cell late one night, and the guards find him dead in his bunk the next morning, maybe helped along with some digitalis or some other drug crumbled up into his food. Don't think the FBI wouldn't murder a helpless old man. As I pointed out in last week's podcast, in essence, they've already done so in Edgar Steele's case, and his actual death would just kind of formalize things. They are quite capable of it, I assure you. Now, the second nasty possibility is that the feds will use this three-month delay to bring an immense amount of pressure on Edgar Steele to confess or make at least some kind of mealy-mouthed statement to the effect that, well, something happened, I didn't mean it, I was doped up, or blah, 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 in order to take the pressure off the whole issue of the altered audio tapes of his conversation with Fairfax, in exchange for a promise of leniency and some hope that he may someday be able to see the world again and go home. Now, this is, to my mind, the most dangerous possibility, and one that shouldn't be taken lightly. I can't imagine what it must be like for Ed Steele at this time. And I want to say something right now. If he does finally break and crawl on his belly in front of these people, I will not in any way, shape, or form hold it against him or sit in judgment on him. I'm not the one sitting in that cell in which he has been buried alive to wait for death. He is. And he would have to be a man of superhuman courage and strength of character to turn down any deal that he's offered, even on the slim and worthless promise of leniency from the monster that's put him there. That's all very well for us to sit out here and talk big about nobility and defiance of the beast for the cause and all this sort of rot when you're not the one sitting in the cell. I understand this, and I want to tell all of you right now that if Steele does finally crack under this inhuman pressure, I will not utter one word of criticism. I will simply state that I don't believe him, and I understand why he had to do what he did. I'll say this now, though. The problem is that in the final analysis, Steele can keep any promise he gives to Zog by recanting and letting them off the hook on the tapes, but he has no way of making sure that these animals in turn keep their word. The prisons are full of men who have rotted away there for years because they thought they had some kind of deal with a U.S. attorney. Right, on to a more pleasant part of the broadcast. Axis Sally's up. When I asked her what she wanted to talk about this week, she said she wanted to read one of the old posts from my Thought Crime blog from some years back, which she'd read and she really liked. It took me a while to figure out which one she was talking about, but eventually it hit me that she was referring to a humorous piece called Take the Ceausescu Challenge. I think it's funny anyway. And by the way, I didn't write this. It's one of the many really great things that just wander in off the internet from time to time. I have no idea who actually wrote it. The tagline on the original said it was by Mustafa Gormsby, which I'll give bets and lay odds isn't the author's real name. Now, I considered running this with all kind of caveats and disclaimers, but what the hell. The author probably intended this as comedy, but there's many a true word said in jest. It's not likely to incite anyone to violence, since American white males don't fight anymore. They write their congressman or bitch to a radio talk show host or hire a lawyer to file a malicious lawsuit. When I first saw this piece about 10 years ago, I knew I had to circulate it. I figured that once, just once, I was going to publish what everybody in this country with any remaining sense of decency truly feels in their heart, no matter what their race or political persuasion. I'll probably get all kinds of flack, but so what else is new? Enjoy!
The vermin on Capitol Hill are stealing over half your income, eroding away your rights, and taking our country on a fast track to the third world. These miserable, thrice-damned whore sons will never stop unless we stop them. It's time to kill them all now. How can we kill them all now? Any way you like. You could hang them, behead them, roast them over an open fire, strangle them with your bare hands, very satisfying, impale them, sell them to a vivisectionist, profitable, run them over with a large vehicle once or with a small vehicle several times, stab them, shoot them, burn them at the stake, string them up with piano wire, chop them up with an axe. Don't use your good chef's knife or you could notch the blade. Bury them up to their necks near an anthill and pour honey on them. Use them for chum when you go shark fishing or any other method that you can imagine. The more horrible it is, the better you will feel about it. Don't we need politicians and bureaucrats for anything? Nope, they don't even make good firewood, so there's really no use for them at all. Remember, these people have stolen a substantial part of your income for the last 80 years. They have spent even more than they have stolen, leaving the country with a $5 trillion debt. They have stolen property from innocent people and used the law as an instrument of plunder and tyranny. Do we need them? No, but they need us. Without us to bleed, they wouldn't be able to live because they are incapable of producing anything for themselves. The miserable bastards don't deserve to live. Scum! Vicious, conniving, baby-eating vermin. They must die, die, die. Kill them all now. You may ask, what would we do without them? Live like free men instead of slaves, that's what. When this country was founded, people knew about things like natural rights. Now, these festering, swilling pigs at the public trough have decided that the people of this country have too much freedom and that it is up to them to curtail it. Bastards! Who do they think they are? 80 years ago, the budget was small enough to be paid for on what the government collects today, even if you got rid of all personal income taxes. But these horrific sons of bitches just keep taking and taking as if there was no limit to what we could tolerate. Is there any precedent for killing them all now? Yes, all over the world and throughout history, people who have suffered at the hands of corrupt politicians have eventually said enough is enough. The French Revolution was a fine example of what to do with politicians out of control. The people of Romania, having suffered under the communist dictatorship of Nicolae Ceausescu for too many years, finally dragged him out into the street and shot him and his bitch dog slut of a wife through the head, an event which was videotaped and shown on national television to the thunderous cheers of the multitudes and which causes real Americans to heave a sigh of envy. Take the Ceausescu challenge. Are you tired of being told how to live? Of being told what you can and cannot eat, smoke, drink, or do with your property? Are you tired of the government taking away your money and spending it on more government? Are you sick and tired of the fact that every time you turn around, another thing you enjoy has been outlawed? There's only one solution. Kill them all now! Hurry before the United States starts looking like Mexico, Brazil, or the Soviet Union. March on your state capital with pitchforks and torches. Lock the bastards in and burn the place down. Then march on Washington, D.C. and do the same. That is where the real evil is. You cannot vote these people out of office because the new ones you vote in will begin to look like the old ones within just weeks. They are a slime and they spread like malaria. They are a disease. Voting won't do any good. It's time to kill. Just the elected officials? No, the number of elected officials is limited to Congress, the President, and the Vice President. That's only 537 people. The federal bureaucracy numbers in the millions between the military, the IRS, BATF, CIA, FBI, EPA, DEA, FDA, and all the other bureaus and departments, you've got millions of people who have power over your life and you never elected them. My God, the post office, don't let them escape. Kill them all now! Filthy, horrible, miserable, status, liberal, feminist, pervert, politically correct, lying, thieving, baby-killing, vermin scum! If you don't kill them all now, there's no telling what they might do to you next. They could use your children to feed starving peasants in India. They could sell your wife or husband to the British to pay off part of their debt. They might turn your children into prostitutes for the government to help continue to fund PBS. Do you want your children to become Barney's whores? Nothing is sacred to these vermin. They are evil. For most of the 20th century, these stinking, loathsome, festering, boil-ridden, poor excuses for life forms have been bleeding the American people dry, and not just at home. The government of the United States has screwed over plenty of people around the world. Not only that, but these shifty-eyed, mindless, drooling, horrible, vicious, evil, demonic, flea-bearing, pestilent, sniveling, whining, toadying, child-molesting power-mongers are the world's number one cause of apoplexy. They'll steal your children and sacrifice them in bizarre satanic rituals. They must be stopped. Voting won't stop them. Petitioning won't stop them. Ballot initiatives won't stop them. Bullets will stop them. Baseball bats will stop them. Pitchforks will stop them. Skinning them alive will stop them. The only thing that will stop them dead is death. Some of you may say, isn't killing them all now kind of drastic? No! They signed up for the job. They stole from you. They lied to you. They stole from you some more. They destroyed the town you live in. They caused the increase in crime across the country. Dora the Explorer has been brainwashing your children to make blind, obedient followers of them. They are evil and they must be killed. Don't let another day of their depredations go by unchallenged. Kill them all now!
I got an email from Gretchen the librarian wanting to know that now I've got Access Sally here giving us the female white nationalist viewpoint. Was she fired? No, Gretchen, you're not fired. I've just had so much on my plate for the show over the past few weeks that I haven't been able to use any of your audios, and I've been keeping them in reserve.
And comrades, lately I've been thinking about this issue of packing the moving van, as Harold likes to say. And the problem is, and I'm sure this is a problem a lot of people have, When I look at my possessions, I pretty much like everything that I have because either it reflects my taste, or it's sentimental, or it has some utilitarian purpose. So I end up liking everything. And of course, if I like everything, I might end up trying to take everything with me to the homeland, but that, of course, can end up being quite expensive, and you can really end up taking too much. So I devised a little game that I like to play with myself, and it helps me tremendously. What I do is I visualize each item having a price tag on it, and I imagine that I'm in some sort of shop, and I say to myself, well, if this had a price tag on it, and it really doesn't matter the price, it could be $15, it could be $200, whatever you want to imagine, it doesn't matter. I ask myself, would I pay for this? And if I say yes immediately, then I know that I'm going to take it with me, because obviously I really like it if I would pay money for it. If I'm kind of vacillating, then I say, well, maybe, but probably not, because I'm vacillating. Other times, I say flat out no. I really wouldn't pay for this. I don't really like it. Then I would say, well, I'll sell it or I'll give it away. And what this little exercise does is it just helps me get much more detached from things and look at it as if I could just sort of take it or leave it. And I just feel that, yes, it's going to be difficult, but I find this little exercise tremendously helpful. So if you find yourself in the same boat that I'm in with these kind of thoughts, I think it's just a wonderful little exercise that I'd mention to you. So thank you for listening.
First music break. This is No Remorse, and the song is called White Country.
Has no say. Too many
Okay, I'm thinking of establishing a new feature slot on this show called Heckler's Corner, wherein I deal with assorted heckles, attacks, rumors, and general bullshit that comes at me in the Northwest Imperative on the Internet. Now, most of this stuff comes from Jews and niggers and lefty liberals, of course, but also from certain white idiots as well. And maybe the Heckler's Corner could even have a kind of a theme song.
They're coming to take me away, ha-ha. They're coming to take me away, ho-ho, hee-hee, ha-ha. To the funny farm where life is beautiful all the time. And I'll be happy to see those nice young men in their clean white coats. And they're coming to take me away, ha-ha.
I'm sorry, I admit I've just been looking for an excuse to play that one on here, but don't worry, I promise I won't go overboard with it. By way of explanation on our first heckle, I run two blogs, the Homeland blog on our northwestfront.org site, and also the Thought Crime blog at http://downwithjugears.blogspot.com, and the comments sections there have become quite popular. And we have a number of regular commenters, and I'm surprised that some of them don't start their own blogs. I've noticed that after V-Bulletin boards, blog comment sections these days seem to be the newest and most popular internet forums, especially if they're unmoderated, and all the Fruit Loops can come out to play. I've seen some blog comments sections that remind me of what Usenet used to be like 15 years ago. Anyway, I get regular heckles and insults and threats from Jews and presumable leftists of various sorts demanding to know why I won't approve their blog comments. Now, the upshot of most of their claims is that I will not approve their comments because I am mean and cruel and a dictator, and they are just so brilliant that I don't dare let them speak. I'm censoring their precious right to free speech, so forth and so on, although in their case, free speech usually consists of long strings of obscene abuse. Now, the usual tone of these things is, Hurl, why didn't you approve my comment calling you 20 different names and showing the world how brilliant and witty I am? You don't dare debate with anyone or take any criticism, Hurl, yada yada yada. I never understood why someone would think that I would allow my own resources and facilities to be used to attack and defame and abuse not just myself, but the Northwest Imperative and white nationalism in general. I think, though, that some of these kikes are genuinely outraged that I will not allow them to post tirades of abuse against me personally, against my ideas, and against my entire race on my websites. They are so unused to anyone denying them anything or thwarting them in any way that it makes them genuinely angry and upset that there is someone left in the world who will tell them to piss off. I'd say these complaints about the blog comment sections on Homeland and Thought Crime come at least 80% from Jews of various kinds, and the rest from whatever three or four individuals are actively goat dancing at Sunstein or whoever is signing their paycheck seems to switch them out every 8 or 9 months, or at least switch out their internet identities. Niggers and Mexicans post all kinds of filth in the comment section all the time, of course, which I never approve, but they never bothered to complain about my not approving them. It's odd, you know, in some respects, niggers and Mexicans seem to be more practical and have more common sense than lefty liberal Jews. First off, yes, these people are to some degree correct. I do maintain fairly strict moderation on my blog's comment sections, and I usually don't knowingly allow Jews or blacks or Mexicans on there unless it's something really humorous that makes them look like fools. This is not a democracy, and I've never pretended it is. There are still a few places on Earth that are still strictly segregated. No niggers or Jews or faggots. And my websites are one of those places. Now, these people have all of the rest of the internet that they can use to vomit all over. They will not be allowed to do so on my sites. There's a couple of exceptions to that, true. The upstate New York blogger and self-published author William Howard Kunstler is Thought Crime's official token Jew. And I've caught some flack for publishing his material, so let's talk about him for a bit. The fact is that some of Kunstler's columns are so outstandingly well written and to the point on certain subjects that I repost a few paragraphs of them sometimes on Thought Crime. Yes, Kunstler is a hippy-dippy 60s retread, and he actively hates poor white people. I know this, especially poor southern white people. And periodically he posts some really nasty and contemptuous stuff about us. Yeah, I've read it. But, to give him his due, he's equally contemptuous of the wealthy Jews who run the financial system. He names names, and he really skewers the rich, and I admit, I really like reading pure hate-filled invective against people who deserve it. And Kunstler is a master of well-written and genuinely witty invective, which is rare. Many Jews are clever, and they can turn a phrase, but few of them have actual wit, humor, wit as Oscar Wilde would have defined the term. James Howard Kunstler has a command of the language and a turn of phrase that I admire, and which I think is to a certain limited extent worth sharing with our people. The art of actual writing is rapidly being lost as we let the internet and all the various electronic screens and images take over our lives, as if we were reverting to drawing pictures on cave walls like we were doing 30,000 years ago. It's being lost because many, I won't say most, but many white people can't actually read anymore. I don't mean a traffic sign or the TV guide. I mean the fact is that most white people, especially younger white people, can no longer sit down and read a block of type for content. And that saddens me beyond measure. It saddens me to see good old-fashioned newspapers replaced by the internet and cable news, so forth and so on. Oh, you know, this is my usual Grandpa Simpson rant against change. Although in this case, Grandpa happens to be right, and the change is for the worse. Anyway, where was I? Oh, yes. The few exceptions to my segregation rule on blog comments. Now, in addition to Kunstler, our official token Jew, there is one other occasion when I will sometimes approve comments from Jews. Every 18 months or so, I repost and update an article that I originally ran some years ago called Jewish Women. And I notice that every time I do, the comments keep on coming, sometimes for months. I don't know how people keep finding that one particular article. Maybe it's some kind of Google search, but scarcely a week goes by when I don't get some kind of comment on one of the other postings of that Jewish Women article. Sometimes even the original version that was posted to Thought Crime 5 years ago, and that's still up. Anyway, I get a lot of screaming abuse from female Jews, of course, but what amazes me is the number of comments I get from Jewish men who say something to the effect of, "Harold, you are a wicked, evil Nazi, and I hate everything you stand for, and I will oppose you with every fiber of my being, blah, 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 ish kabibble, but I have to agree with you. Your description of Jewish women is spot on. God, they're neurotic, castrating bitches, especially Jewish mothers. Believe me, Harold, the stereotype of the Jewish mother is not a stereotype at all. It's God's own truth. Oy vey. And sometimes, I kid you not, I get these Jews sitting there on the internet telling me all about their sexual problems and their problems with their mothers like they're on the psychiatrist's couch. I kid you not. And sometimes I'll approve these comments. And so that's the second exception to my no Jews on the blogs rule.
They're coming to take me away, ha-ha, they're coming to take me away, ho-ho, hee-hee, ha-ha, to the happy home with trees and flowers and chirping birds and basket weavers who sit and smile and twiddle their thumbs and toes, and they're coming to take me away, ha-ha, to the funny farm where life is beautiful all the...
Sorry, I'll get it under control, I promise you. Okay, another criticism I get a fair amount of from what I suppose you might call lilac liberals, i.e. white people who are of the can't-we-all-just-get-along school of thought, is, Harold, what makes you think you are right, and what gives you, Harold, the right to make all these moral judgments on people and tell everybody else what to do? Well, first off, I don't think I'm right. I actually am right. And you're wrong. And that always helps. Some, anyway. It's not decisive, of course. I mean, being right helps, true, but it doesn't necessarily mean that the good guys will win. Look at the American Civil War and World War I and II. One of the lessons from the past 100 years that's very clear is that good does not always triumph over evil. Now, as it happens, I'm right about this Northwest migration thing. Logic and experience and any practical consideration of the problem tells me I'm right, and it will tell you I'm right if you think about it. Now, with that and a dollar, I can buy a cup of watery coffee at McDonald's. Being right most of the time has done me no damn good at all, either in the personal or political sense, but it does give me the prerogative of publicly calling wishy-washy white liberals idiots, which is some consolation. And yes, if you're a liberal, or if you're one of these can't-we-all-get-along jackasses, or if you believe the races are equal and Israel is the fulfillment of biblical prophecy, then you're not just honestly mistaken, you're stupid, and you can't fix stupid. Ignorance is not a point of view. Now, as to how and why I dare make the moral judgment that liberals and nigger lovers and faggots and quote-unquote people who don't agree with me are stupid and wrong, well, I'll tell you what. I will let the late Dr. William Pierce answer for me, which, again, just goes to show that no one is trying to do Pierce down. No one is trying to destroy Pierce's legacy. Are we clear on this, Mr. Spidell? Anyway, this is from one of Pierce's American Dissident Voices from back in the 1990s, that time period that certain people in the movement seem so fixated on.
You know, the reason we used to have a common set of values, the reason we used to be judgmental, is that these things were necessary for our survival. Every time in our daily lives that a decision had to be made, we didn't have to spend all day thinking about it. We didn't have to keep reinventing the wheel over and over. We made judgments based on our common set of values and standards. These values and standards were developed through trial and error over thousands of years. They didn't work all the time. They weren't perfect, but they worked a lot more often than not. They gave us an enormous advantage over any group of people without common values or with values not so well suited to the environment, to the living conditions. They made it possible for us to survive. If you think that we're surviving just fine now without values or with the utterly unnatural, politically correct values which have replaced our natural values, then you're suffering from very serious nearsightedness. You're focusing much too closely on your current credit card spending limit and failing to see many other things of much greater importance. While our values were giving way to political correctness and we were learning not to be judgmental, our people, white people, in the United States, declined from more than 90% of the population to just over 70% today. And as Mr. Clinton is so fond of telling us, we'll become a minority within the next few decades. That is, we will if we remain non-judgmental and continue sitting on our hands. And if you're one of those non-judgmental types, who is not worried by that prospect because really the civilization the Haitians and Vietnamese will give us after they've finished wrecking ours will be just as good as ours ever was, then you're obviously a person who thinks Clinton is an okay guy and you're tuned to the wrong station. I'm not talking to you. I'm talking only to the people who are so politically incorrect that they still think that we ought to do everything we can to preserve our civilization, our values and standards, because they're better for us than anyone else's possibly could be. More than that, I'm talking to the people who want us to survive as a people, as a race, because they understand that our civilization is superior for us because we built it. Our ancestors built it, not someone else's ancestors. And I want to tell all of you politically incorrect listeners, all of you judgmental listeners, that we need to bring our judgmentalism out of the closet again. We need to stand up for the values and standards that served us in the past. We understand that our system wasn't perfect. We understand that we need to improve it. We need to get rid of the weaknesses that allowed the promoters of political correctness to confuse us and morally disarm us. We need to understand that back in the 1960s, when the enemies of our civilization turned our moral world upside down and produced monsters like Bill Clinton, our toleration for these people was a mistake. Toleration, in moderation, may be a virtue when we have our own civilization and our own world. because it permits our values to evolve and adapt to changes in our environment. It permits us to fine-tune our system. And it allows us to have both individual freedom and a society able to protect itself from its own sociopaths as well as its external enemies. But there must be no toleration for the things we permitted to happen in the 1960s. There must be no toleration for the likes of Bill Clinton. There must be no toleration for multiculturalism or for its proponents. Thanks for being with me again today.
Okay, second music break. There are a number of British and American ballads that are very old and very famous, and there's a lot of recorded versions of these songs. I believe that over the past 16 months on Radio Free Northwest, I've already played several versions of the same song more than once. I think I played several versions of The Cruel Sister, which is an old English ballad. She Moved to the Fair, which is an old Irish ballad. The Foggy Dew, an Irish rebel song, and some others. Now, back in January, I played the Walter Forbes version of the old Appalachian murder ballad called Pretty Polly. Forbes was a 1960s folk singer type. This is a more modern bluegrass version of the same song. This is Patti Loveless and the immortal Ralph Stanley.
You're ready for Pretty Polly?
I'm ready.
Okay.
Oh, Polly, Pretty Polly, would you take me in kind? Would you take me in kind? You'd have sat beside me and tell me you're mine.
Well, my mind is to marry and never to part. My mind is to marry and never to part. The first time I saw you, you wounded my heart.
Polly, Pretty Polly, come and go along with me. Polly, Pretty Polly, come and go along with me. Before we get married, some pleasure we'll see.
Well, he led her over mountains and valleys so deep. He led her over mountains and valleys so deep. Polly mistrusted and them began to weep.
Polly, your guess is about right. Polly, Pretty Polly, your guess is about right. I dug on your grave the biggest part of last night.
Then he led her a little farther, and what did she spy? He led her a little farther, and what did she spy? Knew the grave was spent lying by. She knelt down before him and pleading for her life. She knelt down before him pleading for her life. I'll never be a single girl if I can't be a wife.
Well, Polly, Pretty Polly, that never can be. Polly, Pretty Polly, that never can be. Your past reputation and trouble to me.
flown.
And he went down to the jailhouse, and what did he say? He went to the jailhouse, and what did he say? Kill Pretty Polly and trying to get away.
I'd just like to throw in a quick note on employment here in the homeland. This is for all you guys out there who are seriously considering coming home but who are worried that you won't be able to find employment. And yes, I understand that this is a completely legitimate concern, and we'll certainly give prospective migrants all the help we can give them on it. Now, I can't speak from personal experience for every single place in the homeland, but I can tell you that things in the overall Pugetopolis area are beginning to improve economically, very slowly, but just from outside observation, the economy and the employment picture here does appear to be somewhat better than it was this time last year. The greater Puget Sound area, which covers a lot of territory from Olympia in the far south to almost as far north as the Canadian border, has a lot of money in it. It's not like this is some Rust Belt urban area like those in New Jersey or Pennsylvania or Ohio. Now, first off, there's military money due to the extensive Navy and Army facilities here, like the Bremerton Shipyard in Fort Lewis. Secondly, there's state government and tax money due to the presence of the state capital in Olympia. Third, there is major private sector money here due to the presence of serious corporate giants like Microsoft, Boeing, and Starbucks. Amazon.com is opening their big central warehouse facility here in Seattle sometime this summer. I'm not saying that you could necessarily go to work directly for any of these outfits. I'm saying that the presence of money attracts other money. Now, that's the way an economy works. All that money I just mentioned spreads around. All those employees at Starbucks and Fort Lewis have paychecks to spend, and that in turn generates all kinds of subsidiary economic activity. I repeat that overall, while the situation was tight here for a while, and still is, things were never as bad here as they were around the rest of the country at the beginning of the Obama Depression, and they are now showing some signs of improvement. I'll give you an example. Now, you remember that guy I mentioned on this program a few weeks back, the new migrant who isn't really a new migrant because he came from another part of the homeland, but never mind, we won't quibble. Anyway, after he arrived here in the Puget Sound primary settlement area, it took him about 10 days to find his own place to live at a reasonable rent. That's not the Taj Mahal, but no one expects to start out in the Taj Mahal when they move to someplace new. Now, this comrade is now working two jobs here in the Seattle area, one full-time job for $11 per hour that he basically uses to pay the rent, and one part-time job in his own actual field for $20 an hour. So people, it can be done. We're about to do it again. We have a new migrant arriving from the East Coast this week. Yeah, we're finally starting to see some of those out-of-state license plates coming over the hill. I'll keep you posted on how he does on the employment and housing front. It can be done, people. Okay, now on to another topic. I get people asking me all the time, Harold, what's the long-term plan? I've gone over this in the past, and I go over it in the Northwest Front's party manual, the White Book. But like so much else, I need to repeat these things periodically. And by the way, I understand that there's now almost 70 hours of Radio Free Northwest on the party website at northwestfront.org, and that not everybody can download all these podcasts and listen to them all. So I fully expect to do a lot of repeating myself. I should point out, though, that for those of you who want the basics, the September 23rd, 2010 podcast of Radio Free Northwest is an FAQ broadcast. It's about 2 hours, and so if you want to get some of the basics on the front, you might start by downloading and listening to that one. That's September 23rd, 2010. Now, the answer to this latest lady's question is, yes, there is a plan. This is not just a case of, hey, everybody, come here and move to the Northwest just to keep me company. There are, in fact, 4 phases of the plan, called the Butler Plan, which are outlined in the White Book. But the ones that concern us now have to do with the laying of the basic foundation. We need to establish roughly 1,000 Class A activists in the homeland here in the Pacific Northwest, by which I mean men and women who are intelligent, mature, absolutely dedicated to the 14 words of David Lane, economically and personally functional in society, and who are willing to devote themselves to the establishment of the Northwest American Republic as the primary purpose of their lives. In other words, for these first 1,000 people, the Northwest Republic will not be just a hobby. It will not be something that one does in one's leisure time in between trips to the beach and trips to the lake or the Six Flags. The Northwest Republic will not be a computer game one plays for a few hours after work while sitting in one's rec room. The Northwest Republic, for these people, will be a holy and overriding cause that is the most important thing in their lives. It will, in fact, demand a degree of dedication from these people, which I probably shouldn't even specify, because Americans can't really wrap their minds around this type of totally dedicated living, and they would probably be shocked and horrified if they understood my true opinions on the subject. This first 1,000 people, who may or may not be formally initiated as Northwest Volunteers as the situation develops, we don't know that yet. Anyway, they're not going to be concentrated all in one big commune like we were the Rajneesh or some small town out in the North Woods like we were Starship Ruthie or Scientologists or anybody like that. These people need to be distributed all around the homeland, mostly in urban areas or middle-sized towns, where the problems are and where the non-whites are who will create the problems that we have to capitalize on and where the bulk of the white population of the homeland is. Now, I know there's still a lot of people out there who envision Northwest migration as finding someplace really remote and buying some cheap land and setting up a double wide somewhere way out in the woods and digging a well and growing an organic garden and loading yourself up with guns and ammo so you can hide from Obama. The problem is that running off into the North Woods with your family and trying to hide from the United States and the poison that the United States oozes is, in fact, pretty pointless. Ask Randy Weaver and the Montana Freeman how that worked out for them. You can't win a revolution or build a political movement by running and hiding out in the woods. You have to go where the people are and, consequently, where the problems are. The white man needs to stop hiding. I'm not asking you to come here to the Northwest to hide. I'm asking you to come here to prepare for what will be an eventual confrontation between the European-descended population of America on one side and the United States government and its armed men on the other. Now, this first 1,000 Northwest Volunteers I'm speaking of will be placed all across the homeland, although the way things will work out, most of them will probably be in the more urbanized and economically viable areas. They will work in small cells, crews, teams, affinity groups, whatever you want to call them, numbering 5 or 6 people each. Certainly no more than a dozen members max per unit for several reasons. For one thing, 5 or 6 people seems to be the maximum number of white nationalists who can operate together and still get along with one another before the usual dysfunctional American bullshit sets in and it turns into Jersey Shore. I'm hoping and counting on the likelihood that this long-standing and well-recognized characteristic of our movement will heal itself once these cells or teams of people actually have something political and racial to do. I've always suspected that a lot of the dysfunctional movement crap that goes on in our many little organizations is the result of the devil making work for idle hands, but we won't get into that. Also, many cells of 5 or 6 people is better than one big community of 1,000 people because it's far harder for the FBI to infiltrate and fabricate evidence and frame 200 small groups of 5 people each than one big group of 1,000. They would have to hire 200 Larry Fairfaxes to follow 200 small groups of people around and try and get them to talk into the microphone about hiring a hitman to kill somebody. Now, once those teams of 5 or 6 absolutely dedicated Northwest Nationalist people start getting into place, then they begin their overt political and propaganda activity in the white community in their area of the Northwest. They do it after they get together and they've got a support system. We've done a fair amount of stuff based on just lone wolves, one guy sitting out all alone in some little town in the Northwest, but we need for our unit leaders to have a support system, hence the team. Now, this is what might be called the traditional phase of movement activity, your leaflets and stickers and spray-painted slogans on the wall, your little meetings in people's basements and garages, and maybe even the odd rented motel banquet room if nothing else is available, although that will be one requirement for a unit. You will need a gathering place or two besides those god-awful motels. In essence, for a brief time, the Northwest Front will become an actual political movement, And this should satisfy all those people who moan and groan that we never do anything, although I'm sure those same people will then find something else to moan and groan about. Now, beyond that, I don't want to speculate too much as to what will happen, and it's not just because I'm being cautious and trying to cover my ass. I honestly don't know. I don't have a crystal ball. A lot of how the Northwest Front proceeds will depend on how the political, racial, and economic situation in North America develops in the coming years. Now, I've laid out a possible scenario or two in my Northwest novels, but something completely different may be coming down the pike. We just don't know. I'm not going to sit here and pontificate about, oh, well, by the year 2015, we'll be doing this, and by the year 2020, we're going to be doing this, because no one can really tell. What I'm saying is we have to be in place and ready to handle whatever comes down the pike. Right now, I'm not worrying about that phase of things too much. Right now, I'm concentrating on finding the right words to get you to pack that moving van and get your ass up here where you're supposed to be, so that we can get that first 1,000 volunteers in place and functioning and start on the Northwest communities. Okay, third music break. Look, like I said, I've had to change computers. The song that I wanted to play right now was on the other computer. All I have on here right now is some miscellaneous odds and sods. I know that I have played this number before, but I feel in a bagpipey mood. Anyway, this is called The March of Cambrath, and it was the theme song to our infamous NVA attacks video.
Thank you. feet to a marching drum. We'll win the war and pay the toll. We'll fight as one in heart and soul. Midnight mare and blood red roan. Fight to keep this land your own. Sound the horn and call the cry. How many of them can we make die? Axes flash, broadswords swing, shining armors piercing a ring. Houses run with a powder shield. Fight those bastards till they yield. Midnight mare, blood red roan. Fight to keep this land your own. Sound the horn and call the cry. How many of them can we make die?
Now I want to close out this week's edition with yet another variation on a very old theme. As you'll know if you've been listening to Radio Free Northwest for a while, I got a lengthy email this week from one of our listeners who is not just a listener but an actual supporter, and I've already talked to her privately about her concerns. I won't read out the email because I'm afraid that when I do that, sometimes it sounds like I'm dressing our own people down or reading them the riot act, and that's not my intention. Most of the complaints and concerns I get from listeners are not just eccentric objections just to be cranky. In most cases, they reflect fairly widespread views that are held by a lot of people in our little movement or subculture, whatever you want to call this thing of ours. So when I do this, bear in mind that I'm not quote-unquote attacking anybody or trying to put them down or anything like that. I'm trying to deal with ideas rather than individuals on here, but the fact is that there are still a lot of ideas floating around out there that are just plain wrong. And we've reached a point in the crisis of our race and civilization where wrong-headed ideas are no longer just irritating, they're starting to become dangerous. We have got to get our heads together and get our minds right, people. And we have to do it now because we're running out of time. Now, this means that incorrect ideas have to be combated and discredited. As the communists would say, we need to establish a correct line. There are an amazing number of white nationalists who still have no very clear idea in their heads as to exactly what the issue is, which is the very survival of the white race on the planet Earth, and what we have to do in order for that race to survive past the next 100 years. They're still very unclear as to what exactly it is that we're trying to achieve. Specifically, you might call these people the BCs, the Beaver Cleavers. Or maybe the BBs would be better, the Brady Bunch believers, since most people these days don't remember Leave It to Beaver. The fact is that for almost the entire existence of what's passed for a white nationalist resistance in this country, actual white revolutionaries have been very thin on the ground. The overwhelming majority of people who have comprised every major movement tendency, from the old John Birch Society to the Ku Klux Klan to the populists and various cartoid permutations, down to today's Tea Party, are essentially conservatives. With a varying level of racial consciousness, but all too often, when you really get to know these people, their racial feelings are only a part of their main concerns, which tend to be social and economic. Now, let me say here and now, there is not a damn thing wrong with being concerned about social and economic conditions in America. Indeed, these are generally the first irritants that tend to get white people stirred up and woken up and make them start noticing what's going on around them because they affect them personally. Now, I was lucky, I suppose you'd call it. I got thrown into an integrated high school when I was 15, and my first introduction to the crisis was purely racial in the form of rampaging gangs and niggers running through the halls. But I know that most people didn't arrive at their present level of political awareness by that route. White Americans are a purely materialistic and economic people. And with most of them, they're so wrapped up in their personal lives and their personal pursuit of wealth and material possessions that they don't notice a damn thing about what's going on around them until you hit them in their wallets. Essentially, the majority of white nationalists, depending on how you define the term, are primarily conservatives, not revolutionaries. I've said this before, but it bears constant repetition, because we have to understand ourselves and why we need to do this Northwest thing before we can be motivated to do it. And most of us, deep down, do not want to change the whole system from top to bottom. We just want the system to work for us personally. We want America to keep its promise to us personally. We want the whole suburban lifestyle, two cars in a garage, 2.3 kids, and all the wonderful luxuries that we have been conditioned to believe we're entitled to as Americans, but without all the bullshit, without all the black and brown faces all around, without the gabble of Spanish in the stores and always having to hit two for English at the ATM, and without the constant fear and uncertainty that America makes us live with. We want to live in the world of the Brady Bunch, and we want all to be right with that world. Now, this is completely human, completely understandable, and I get it, believe me. Now, what we have to get through our heads is that this is no longer possible. Things have simply gone too far, and this idealized past, if it ever existed, can never be recovered. The clock always moves forward, never backwards. A revolutionary movement is not a time machine to take us back to the past. It's a vehicle to move us forward into a future that we've created for ourselves and not some government bureaucrat sitting in an office in Washington, D.C. with a big federal budget and a rubber stamp. If we attempt this thing with the idea that we are somehow going to bring back the 1950s or some other vision we have of an idealized past, we will fail because we will be attempting something that is not possible of human achievement. We cannot bring back the past. If we did, it wouldn't be the real thing anyway. Beaver Cleaver and Marsha Brady would be zombies, because backlash never replays like the original. And the whole complex set of social and political and economic conditions that created that idealized past way back then would no longer exist. The past 50 years of horrible history can't be erased. Now, if we want, we can possibly create a future for ourselves that contains the better elements of that past, but only after we achieve state power and we control our own destinies. Now, that's what this whole Northwest thing is about, really. The 14 words, yes, but in order for us to make the 14 words a reality, we have to achieve our own country, our own government, our own economy, and our own national consciousness. People, there is no alternative to revolution. There is no alternative to the total and complete reordering of every aspect of life from top to bottom, politically, racially, socially, economically, and spiritually. We cannot bring back the old. We can only create the new, and it's going to be hard. No flying saucers are going to come out of the sky and blow up the White House for us, as great as that looks in the movies. No one is going to wave a magic wand and make 100 million black and brown and yellow and sodomitic people who should not be here disappear in a puff of smoke. In order for us to do what has to be done, we're going to have to give up much of what has made us what we are. Things like democracy, things like wildly excessive material wealth that we don't really need, things like the comforting luxury of living our personal lives while ignoring politics and ignoring everything that's going on in the world around us, things like the luxury of living only for ourselves, and things like that wonderful past that some of us knew and others of us only dream about because we see it on TV. White Americans have stumbled through life over the past 50 years in a state of obliviousness to the terrible things that have been happening to our world. And that's another luxury we're going to have to give up. The luxury of laziness. We're going to have to quit wandering off into American daydreams, all red, white, and blue. And we're going to have to start paying attention to what's going on around us. And that, so far, we have refused to do. Which is why we're now on the verge of extinction. Now, we can make new Beaver Cleavers and Marsha Bradys in our Northwest Republic, but they're going to have to be raised with a rifle by their cradle to defend the existence of their people, and they will have to be taught at a very early age that life is not a gift. It is a responsibility. We have to make a completely new world and a new way of life for the white man here in the Northwest, people. And for that, I need you here. I need you squared away in your mind and in your personal life, and I need you ready to get to work, because we don't have a whole hell of a lot of time left. Well, that's all for poor old Arlo. Well, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194, or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.